I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast. This is going to be episode number 264.
That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a podcaster. You could check him out online at ATFMB on Twitter, and you can check out his website, ATFMB.com. And I am John Anilio. I am a songwriter, a musician, a composer, a teacher, a podcaster. You could follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And today we are happy to be joined by Helen Lowe. She's a novelist. She's a winner of the Gemma Morningstar Award in 2012 for The Air of Night. She's the author of the Wall of Night series, including the new book, which is called The Daughter of Blood. Helen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You can also follow her on Twitter at Helen Lowe, but I believe the O is a zero in Helen Lowe, L-0-W-E.
It is a zero, yeah.
Yes, and, yeah. And her website is helenlowe.info. And you are coming from New Zealand, is that correct?
That is Christchurch, New Zealand, in the Southland.
So when we are recording, so I am in New Jersey. Patrick is in Colorado. It is approximately almost 1 p.m. My time, and it is would be 11 a.m. Patrick's time on Saturday. What time and day is it for you?
It is Sunday morning at around about 6:45 in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
We've come to take this as commonplace at this juncture, but when you really sit and think about it, it is quite amazing that, you know, people from opposite sides of the world can have these kinds of conversations. It still kind of blows me away from time to time when I think about it.
Yeah, I think we're about 10,000 miles away from each other.
That's
as well as 18 hours. Yep.
Yeah, so that's insane stuff. But so thank you for taking the time, and I know it sometimes can be like kind of an awkward time, but we appreciate you doing that to come on the show today.
So, you know, it's kind of funny, John. You know how there's like the cliche thing where it's like, oh, you're from such and such? I know someone from there. Have you ever met the, you know, it's that whole thing. So Travis Heerman is a friend of mine, and his wife got a fellowship kind of thing. Believe it or not, fellowship in New Zealand. And
of the rings.
Exactly. Yeah. And is living there for like a year now. And I almost actually, I was like, oh, Travis is there. Do you know Travis? No, just. I am curious about one thing, you know, because Peter Jackson did all the Hobbit stuff there. New Zealand has kind of become famous for Hobbits and the Lord of the Rings stuff. Does that bug the crap out of people there?
There probably are some people it bugs the crap out of, but most people I know are pretty okay with it.
Okay.
Because I guess they feel it put us on the map as well.
There you
pretty
go.
Small country, you know, right down the bottom of the world. So, yeah, now everyone knows where we are.
Wow.
Yeah, and the other thing that I wanted to mention, you know, especially talking about the distance between us, is Patrick and I both mentioned before we started recording how we've both been Twitter friends with Helen for
very
years
long time.
Now.
Yeah.
I feel like we probably all joined around the same time, and you know, the community, especially back then, was smaller and tighter probably than it's a little bigger now. But it, again, it's so interesting. It's this idea of in some marketing books they'll call this weak ties, where it's like, you know, oh, you know this person and I kind of know this person, and so it's always nice, and it's one of the great things about the podcast is that these people who are icons on our screen, like little icons or avatars on our screen coming by, it's like, yeah, that's a real person that you can talk to too. It's not just someone that is putting up 140 character thoughts a couple times a day. So again, it's a thing that that I always take great joy in. You know, and the only other opportunity you have is at cons and things. And even then, I don't even know how many cons you would come to that would bring you over to North America. Have you done many cons where you go overseas?
I've only done one, which was the World Con in Melbourne in 2010.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I was going to say, I don't remember seeing you at any recent World Cons.
No, it's a long way to travel, thousands of miles, and coming from this direction anyway, it's pretty expensive. So, yeah, I have tended not to get to many cons, and So I do a lot over the internet for that reason.
Sure.
It's a way of connecting with people where you don't have to get on the plane and pay the big dollars. And so that's why I do a lot of blogging as well. I have my own blog, but I also guest on SES Signal occasionally. Mm-hmm. And there's another blog, Supernatural Underground, which I post on once a month. It used to just be HarperCollins authors. So my book, my War series is published by HarperCollins in the States. And it used to be all HarperCollins authors on this blog. But like most things, it's changed over time and there's all sorts of different people there now.
When I had the editing gig at SF Signal, I think I actually used to edit your column.
Yes, yeah. I think back then I was doing Fun with Friends.
Yep.
And that was a column where I featured other SFF authors in Australia and New Zealand. But when I got really busy with the book, sort of organising other people got a little bit time consuming sometimes. So I switched and now I do a column called Fantasy Heroines That Rock My World.
Nice.
And just looking at, different characters and books that I've loved over the years and I guess have sort of kept me inspired with the genre. And the other good thing about that is that I can look back. So I've looked at sort of historical heroines like Eowyn, of course, and then but also doing more recent heroines as well and sort of, the 80s and yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. And this was this month in terms of booking guests, including Helen, it was really an interesting bit of synergy or synchronicity because when I look to have guests on the show, a lot of times it'll be people that I know on social media that I want to have on. Various publicists will email me and asking if we'd be interested in having certain people on. And I think this round of recording, it was all through publicists, but it was all people that I knew that I would have wanted on anyway. So it was like, yeah, sure, well, Helen, no problem. So it was like really easy. It was a really easy month of booking for me, Patrick, because everybody, it was all through publicists, but it was all people I wanted to have on anyway. So it was a really great bit.
All right. There. So basically what you're saying is that I need to send some publicists emails and tell them that they need to make it more difficult on you.
Yes, please do. That'd be great. All right. Well, let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Helen, why don't you go first? Why don't you tell us what your pick is this week?
Okay, my pick of the week is the NASA app, which is an app you can get for your, the one that I've got for is a tablet, but I'm sure you can get it for iPad and that as well. But it lots of NASA stuff, so space photos, what's happening with all their different projects and star systems and it's just really cool. So if you're into space and exploration, it's the app for you.
I like that they just released over 10,000 photos of the moon landings.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's really cool.
Oh, it's
yeah.
Incredible. They're like, you know what? We're just tired of all the conspiracy theories. So here's every photo in high def that we've ever done from the moon. Shut up.
Yeah. Well, one of my big ambitions is to go to the Space Center at Cape Canaveral. And do they still call it Cape? I think they do call it Cape Canaveral.
Yeah.
And and see all the stuff from the moon landings and all the other exploration things. So
what you're saying is we need to make a. Is Cape Canaveral? That's in Florida, right?
Yeah.
It is.
We need to have an Orlando or a Florida WorldCon. And
then you can, that would make that happen.
Then you could do both, right? You could come to WorldCon and go to Cape Canaveral.
Yeah.
All right, make that app, people. You know, that reminds me, you're talking about the NASA app. It reminds me of, I did a gig a few years ago with Molly Lewis and the Double Clicks and a couple of other folks, and they were really into this stuff too. And they kept checking this website called How Many People Are in Space Right Now. I think, I don't know if that's the actual name of it, but because of the space station and everything else, it would always like, there are 6 people in space right now. And I got that right there because I never thought about that because I'm not as hardcore of a space person as a lot of people in our genre are, but there are, I know there are a lot of people that, you know, the listeners of this show and other folks like yourself are big, that's a big interest of theirs is constantly knowing what's going on in terms of space exploration and research and what have you. And I never really thought about that. It's like, oh yeah, there's always somebody in space between the space stations and stuff. So it's funny. It's not as daily part of the, of a person's life as I think it was, you know, when space exploration first started, where like the whole world sort of hinged on, you know, different launches and that kind of thing.
Well, in the early, or actually in the late 90s, early 2000s, John, there was a, remember when everybody would buy like screensavers for their computer, right? Mm-hmm. And you had like the flying toasters and all that kind of crap. there was a SETI screensaver. Mm-hmm. And essentially what it did was SETI needed computer time, right? They needed people to be looking at all the signals, and there wasn't enough people doing that. So there was essentially a SETI screensaver that when you put it on your computer, it would analyze signals from SETI, and you were kind of part of the SETI program by just having the screensaver on your computer. And it kind of used your idle computer time to go through the data and look at stuff. And I don't know if that still exists or not, but I always thought that was kind of cool.
I think there's versions of it that still do, like, are people using, you know, unused computer, time for that thing. But sure. That's really cool. Cool. Okay. Patrick, what's your pick this week then?
So my pick this week is something that I am late to the party on, and I know that. I actually missed this when it aired originally. But it's the Sherlock Holiday Special, The Abominable Bride.
Okay.
I don't know if you caught this or not. In America, it was on Masterpiece Theater, or they call it, was it Masterpiece Mystery on PBS. So it wasn't on BBC America. So that's what kind of threw me. I kept looking for it on BBC America, and it didn't air there. So I ended up actually ordering the DVD. Off of Amazon, and I got the DVD and got to watch it. But this, it was really, really cool. It's the modern Sherlock from BBC, you know, Cumberbatch, and John Watson. But now it's them in the Victorian. It's in the classic Sherlock Holmes setting, and it's a fascinating show, and I really, really liked it. It's probably a little over an hour, maybe. Maybe two. I'm not sure the length of it, but
it is a bit long. Is it a bit longer? I think.
It might be an hour and a half, like 90 minutes or something like that.
And the Sherlock episodes are typically about 90 minutes, I think.
Yeah, and it was great. It was wonderful, and I don't want to give too much away about it, but it was really fun to see those two actors taking their characters back to the Victorian age. You know, and also seeing some of the other characters like John's wife and different people, you know, having to, now they're in the Victorian era, you know, there's this.
It really is John's wife, I think.
Yes.
Isn't she?
Yes.
The actress. Sorry. Don't mean to interrupt. But,
Well, Mary. Excuse me. It's funny to see Mary, you know, sitting there going, well, what do you want? What am I supposed to do if you're going out? And he's like, oh, she says, am I supposed to just sit here? And he's like, no, dear, of course not. You know, we're going to be hungry eventually. And you're going, what? In the modern show, she would have kicked him in the balls for that. You know, it's just, I don't know. It was such a trip, and I really enjoyed it. There was so many great scenes in it, and it reminded me a little of a short story that Alvaro wrote, Alvaro Zinnasamara, about Sherlock Holmes. So I would definitely check that out, The Abominable Bride.
Cool. You know, my pick last week was Ryan Britt's Luke Skywalker Can't Read, and he does have an essay about Sherlock Holmes in there about how he's in some ways like the first science fiction character. And I never thought about it that way, but he makes a really interesting point about him, and he talks about how Star Trek references Sherlock Holmes quite a bit through its run, and how it's even and how it's even sort of implied that Sherlock Holmes is one of Spock's relatives and things, you know, so he goes into all of these different things with it. And it's really interesting. I never thought about it that way, but he makes some really good points about sort of the ongoing impact of Sherlock Holmes on on genre fiction. And,
well, and I always talk about it. John Joseph Adams. I think he's ready to hit me when I mention it. But one of my favorite anthologies that he did was The Improbable Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And and it definitely puts Sherlock and Watson into these spec fic scenarios, and they have to deal with it, you know. And when you put the very logical mind of Sherlock Holmes into a story that is dealing with Cthulhu, you know, it's a trip. And it's to this day, it's one of my favorite anthologies.
Cool. My pick this week is the Amazon Prime show, The Man in the High Castle, based on the book by Philip K. Dick. Now, I remember there was a lot of excitement about this show when it was first introduced, and a lot of people liked the pilot. I then also remember that when it did, the whole season appeared back in November, I remember there was, I would say, more mixed reviews about it. I gave up on it. Yeah, and that seemed to be you're in a camp with quite a few people. I feel like a lot of people watched a few episodes and were like, "Yeah, not for me." And a lot of people liked it. I fall in the camp that liked it. I found it to be rather compelling. I did not read the book, so I did not have the book as background for it. And for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, the series takes place in the 60s, but in an alternate timeline where Germany and Japan won World War II and are then occupying North America. So it takes place where New York is and the East Coast is run by the Nazis and the West Coast is run by the Japanese. And I found it to be really compelling. I can see what, and in some ways, like very, even though I don't feel it's a particularly graphic show in terms of the violence, but just sort of all of the kind of atrocities of World War II just sort of being played in a very kind of offhanded, like, yeah, that's just the way this world works kind of a way is really creepy. And that's one of the things that made it quite compelling to watch. I really liked it. Again, I would say, you know, give it an episode or two. If you don't like it, then I think that you'd be with a lot of people who dropped off on it. But I like plowed right through it. I actually watched a lot of it on a couple weekends ago. We got a crazy amount of snow here on the East Coast, so I think I watched like 3 or 4 episodes on the Saturday where we were snowed in. So maybe that's why. Maybe I was just like in it, you know, right away. A lot of the shows, if you get like 4 episodes in, then you're kind of committed. But I really liked it. I thought it was really well done. I thought the acting was good. I thought the writing was good. I thought the tone was really good. The composer is Henry Jackman, who's done a lot of really great movies too, so I really like the music in it as well.
I watched 3 episodes, John, and I was very bored with it.
I can see that. It's not an action-packed show. There's not even a lot in terms of the plot moving forward necessarily. I think it's very.
Is it about the characters?
Yeah.
Does it focus on the character development? And it sounds quite an interesting premise to me. I mean, I obviously know the short story, but played out to a sort of series, it sounds quite.
But if to me, if the characters are boring, you know, if there's nothing there for me to get into, I don't mind. I mean, I actually love a good character-driven story. But in this case, you know, there was no one that I connected with. There was nothing to drive me forward to watch it. And I was also, that came out right after Mom's gallbladder surgery, so we were kind of watching it together. She did not care for it at all. It was bringing back memories of World War II for her, and it was really bothering her. And so she was like, "I don't want to watch this anymore. I don't want to see this anymore." So that was interesting too. You know, it was like it was definitely evoking emotions in her, and she wanted nothing more to do with it.
And I think that's a common thing too, because I did sort of pitch this to other people who were like, yeah, I don't, who are older, who are of a generation who remember World War II. And they're like, no, I'm not interested in watching something where the Nazis won. I'm sorry. Not even as you're, I would say, Helen, more than anything else, it's a real kind of mood piece. So it is kind of slow. And even the character development is kind of slow. So if you can let it sort of envelop you, and that's what worked for me. But I think all of the criticisms or the lack of interest for it from some circles, I get it. I get why it's not for everybody, but it worked for me. So it's definitely worth checking out a couple episodes at least anyway. So
yeah, I think I'd give it a go from what you've seen with reservations because,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
Patrick.
Yes, yeah. Trust Patrick's opinion too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, now getting back, getting on to the main thing before we do that, I do also want to take a moment to mention that if you like the show, if you like what Patrick and I do here at Functional Nerds, you can join the 41 patrons that we have who support this show every month. They back it over on patreon.com, and that's patreon.com/functionalnerds. And you could choose a level that works for you. You could do $1 a month. You can do $5 a month. And that really helps support the show financially. It helps. So, you know, there are costs that go into the show, so it really helps us out, and we're very appreciative of the 41 people that that support us now. And if you get value out of the show, if you enjoy these kinds of interviews with Helen and other people that work in genre, you know, consider backing us. Once again, patreon.com/functionalnerds. Now, Helen, so with your new book, The Daughter of Blood, which is the third book in this in your Wall of Night series.
Which is an awesome series.
Thank you.
Maybe you can, you know, I don't know. Now, is this a kind of series where you can come in on book three, or do you really, is it much more beneficial to start right at the beginning?
I have to say, I think it's probably much more beneficial to start at the beginning because I do try and put in little reminders to people about what's happened in the previous books, but it is one story told in four parts. And, so it's ongoing in that sense, and it is quite a big, complex story. So I think kind of starting from the beginning and reading through is going to be a lot more beneficial for people. But, yeah, having said that, I do – it depends on the reader, but I do try and – with this last two books, this third one and the previous one, I try to have, like, a story that sort of resolves within the book as well as the ongoing story. So people who are quite robust in that sense might still be okay, you know, reading.
I still say
book.
Start at the beginning. Start at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that's a thing that authors struggle with sometimes, and what, you know, especially with, you know, we get all these books sent to us, and a lot of times that'll be part of the pitch. It's like, yeah, it's book four, but it's a, and sometimes it is a starting off point because maybe it's going in a different era of the world or something like that, and that's fine. But I don't think excuses need to be made for that. I think people who read this genre are very happy to maybe discover something and be like, oh, great, there's four books. I can just go and launch right from the beginning.
Exactly.
And that's a real comfort to people. That's really exciting.
So, you're going to sit down, you're going to read the first book, which I think is Heir of Night.
Yes, that's right. The Heir of Night.
So you're going to read that first book, and then you're going to go, oh, right, I've got three more I can read.
Yeah. Well, only two at the moment, but working on the fourth one, which is the final one in the series. Yeah.
Your book, you know, because you're located in New Zealand and this does get published in North America and different parts of the world, what is the release schedule for the stuff? Is it generally all released around the same time? Does it get released certain places first? How does that generally work?
Well, it pretty much gets released simultaneously in the US, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand.
Who's your publisher?
In the US, it's HarperCollins Voyager, and in the UK, it's Orbit.
Okay.
And it's the Orbiter. UK, Australia, and New Zealand are like tied together.
So now, is that something that you have any sort of control over, or is that just sort of, you know, luck to have it all published at the same time?
No, the publishers work that out between them, but I think it's in their interest to cooperate over things like the dates. they seem to anyway. So, and it makes it a lot easier for me. I think with Air, they came out a little bit differently, but only like about a week and a half apart. And so it's like, oh, I'm launching my book. Oh, I'm launching my book again. So having it all happen sort of like on the same day or two is, quite easy. So
now, you know, I was reading through some recent posts on your blog, and one of the things that I came across that I found rather interesting is this post titled Names Matter. And I think names, particularly within fantasy fiction, are very important. So maybe you can give us some of your thoughts on names in your books and just why they do matter in general.
Well, I guess it's an evolving interest because initially when I started writing the story, I did have some thoughts about the names, which is that I tried to use syllables in common between the names within the like the main sort of Dari society to sort of get some coherence to the names and then differentiate to other parts of the world. But I guess the story I told on my blog was I was using the same joining syllable a little bit too often. And so one of the names was, a lot of the names were a bit too similar. And I thought people are just going to get really confused by this. So I thought I need a few name changes. And there was one character who was meant to be quite a minor character in the story, an honor captain. And I thought, oh, I'll just change your name. And so I changed it from whatever it was then, forgotten, to Azantir. And as soon as I did that, like the whole character changed, just became suddenly much more important in the story. And that's sort of continued throughout. And so I was kind of like, now when someone says to me, oh, like my editor, I think with a character in the last book, one of the secondary characters says there was something about his name that was a bit confusing or a bit too similar to something else. Maybe we could change the name. And I'm instantly very nervous. I'm kind of thinking this could change the whole character. What am I going to do? So I do think I spend a lot of time thinking about it now. But in terms of going out into the wider world beyond the Dari and the Wall of Night itself, I tend to use historical influences for the cultures and the names. So, for example, on the river, you have the city of Ish, and that's quite Italianate. And so the names are not overtly Italian, but that Italian Renaissance influence is there. And in the second book, a place called Emir was quite significant in the story, and the names there are definitely, the society is based on the Burgundian knights in the late Middle Ages, and the names all have French, Old French, Norman French influences. And even though I sort of fantasize the writing of the names, yeah. So a lot of thought does go into it.
And you know, related, another thing you've talked about recently and had a contest on your website is Tuckerization. Mm-hmm. So maybe for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with that concept, maybe you can explain what it is and then how you incorporate it into your recent novel.
Okay, so Tuckerization is when an author takes the name of a real person and puts it in their novel. And Tucker was the guy, or Tuck, that first did it. So now the expression is you've been tucked if your name gets in the novel with a Tuckerization. And I guess when The Air of Night, the first book, came out, I just thought that would be a fun thing to do for as part of the celebration, to have a contest. So anyone who commented on my blog, their name goes in a draw, and whoever wins it, they're a character in the next book. So the first winner was a woman called Jan Butterworth, and because I was well into writing the second book at that stage, she only comes into it in the very last part of the book. But the second character, the one who's in this new book that's just come out, Daughter of Blood, she was very challenging. That's an English woman, Cheryl Graham. And I thought, how on earth do I fit Cheryl Graham into an epic fantasy alternate world where they have all these sort of strange names? And it was a little bit challenging at first. But then what I did was I split the name. So it's Cheryl, Cheryl. So I put a hyphen in the middle, and then G, hyphen G, hyphen capital R. So it's Cheryl Graham. And as soon as I did that, it was that name thing again. The whole character just emerged. And she's actually quite an important character in the book, in a secondary sense, yeah.
Yeah, because that must be difficult to take a modern name and try to work it into this, you know, more of a historical kind of context, because you can't just have, it's Jessica Smith. Doesn't really work in this context. And I've heard authors complain about that, too, because there are some modern names that do have, you know, that were used in more... older times, you know, something like Brian. You know, Brian was a name that's been around for a long time, but it does take people out of it still sometimes. You thought, like, Brian? Where's a Brian coming from? And, you know, but, you know, some of these names are old and have been around, so sometimes it works, but that's an interesting solution.
You've got to think about people's expectations as well as what is true, you know, and you get that with science a lot. Like, you know, science fiction movies, for example, you kind of think the science is fantasy science, but part of that is what people expect, and the real science would probably throw them out a little bit. So I think it's kind of similar with the names. You have to think about people's expectations as well as what is true. So, yeah.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, well, we are just about out of time. So before we do wrap it up, once again, I want to let people know you can check out Helen's website, helenlowe.info, and you can follow her on Twitter at Helen Lowe, but in the O, it's a zero, so L-0-W-E. And her newest book is Daughter of Blood, but it is the third book in her Wall of Night series. So why don't you just go right ahead and buy all three books? Why don't you just all go and do that? I think that's really the most prudent. Prudent course of action moving forward. Before we wrap it up, though, Helen, is there anything else that you want to let our readers know about before we go?
Oh, that's always a question, isn't it? I'm going to tell you a little story about this book, which is there's one truly glorious cavalry charge in it, led by a new character, a sort of really relatively minor character, a captain. And when I was trying to prune back the book, because it was pretty big to start with, I thought I can take this character and his whole little arc out and the charge goes. And all my beta readers said with one voice, no, you can't. So that character and that charge are still in the book. So I hope people, when they get to that stage of their reading, will enjoy it. Yeah.
Excellent. Very good. Once again, for us, functionalnerds.com, thank you for listening. If you like what we do, head on over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and consider becoming one of our patrons over there. Patrick, anything you'd like to let people know about before we go?
Come find me on ATFMB.
Sweet. All right, everybody, have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?